Hi, this is Dean Peterson. I'm doing research for a podcast called That Doesn't Happen Every Day.
That's me calling and leaving a message with someone in Denver, Colorado.
I found an article published by the Denver Public Library.
When you have a podcast, especially one like this, you end up leaving a lot of weird messages with people you've never met before.
In a nutshell, it says that there was a single-family residence about where your place is now, and apparently some of the strange events that happened there were the inspiration for a horror movie called The Changeling.
To be honest, this is actually a recreation of that call, because I didn't want to get in trouble with recording a phone call or anything like that. But I promise you, that really is the way that this call went. Not only did I sound kind of nervous or unsure of myself, I managed to say the name of my own podcast like it was a question.
That doesn't happen every day.
The horror movie I mentioned on the phone, The Changeling, came out in 1980 and shouldn't be confused with the 2008 Clint Eastwood, Angelina Jolie film just called Changeling, also a great movie. The Changeling features George C. Scott, who'd played Patton in Patton and later would be Ebenezer Scrooge in a 1984 version of A Christmas Carol. In The Changeling, Scott plays a musician and composer who, after seeing his wife and daughter killed in a car wreck on a skiing trip, leaves New York City to teach at a college in Seattle, where he moves into an old mansion with a terrible past. I think The Changeling is one of my favorite horror movies because it has all of the elements I love in movies like that. It has a huge, lonely house, a hidden room at the top of a hidden staircase, an unsolved murder, a body buried under someone's home, and it also has all the fuzzy, grainy look and audio quality that a lot of the movies from the 70s and early 80s had. I was really sad when I found out that the big mansion in The Changeling wasn't real. It really was just a facade built for the film, but then this happened.
I ran across mention of The Changeling, I think, in our card catalog.
That's Katie Rudolph, the woman who wrote the article for the Denver Public Library that I was calling around Denver about.
Russell Hunter, you know, I read his account of the haunting that he experienced in this Cheeseman Park home, and just kind of wanted to like actually see if there was any historical facts as part of that story that I could verify.
Believe me, when I found out that one of the men credited with writing the story for The Changeling claimed to have had experiences like what you see in the movie in an old house, not in Seattle, but as close to me as Denver, I really, really wanted Katie to find out everything she could, too.
Russell Hunter, you know, he was laughing at the woman who was saying, oh, you have a poltergeist.
On this episode of That Doesn't Happen Every Day, in which we interview everyday people about things that don't normally happen every day, we talk with Katie Rudolph about her research into The Changeling and the possible true events that might have happened to someone in an old house only about a mile from Colorado's Capitol building, and how much of it might not have happened at all.
I've had some people where, like, their mental health is being impacted.
That's Katie again, talking about why some people feel inclined to visit the Denver Public Library.
Do you want to feel comfortable in your home? And they just are not feeling that way. People are hearing noises, or they're having terrible dreams, or they may have seen something, or they just get, like, this really off feeling.
The idea of scared, sleep-deprived people showing up at the library to find out why they're seeing ghosts sounds like something from a lot of other horror movies I've seen.
People wanting to know, okay, did something happen in my home? Did someone commit suicide? You know, we can look and see with the resources we have.
Since this interview with Katie, I've asked a few other librarians about having to help people with paranormal problems. And so far, two others have said, yeah, this happens to us sometimes.
You know, we don't always find an answer. Sometimes we do, and we're like, yes, it appears someone was murdered in your home.
I asked Katie if any of the people she helps run out of the library screaming after finding out that their 3-bedroom, 2-bath on a quiet street was the scene of a double homicide.
In some ways, it's like relief, like, oh, okay, this kind of makes sense. So I worked in Colorado Springs at their public library before this job, and we had something known as the Homicide Index. And a former police officer had gone through the newspapers, indexed every single homicide. So you could go by address. And that got used a lot.
People fond of that murder index weren't just people into scary things or true crime writers either.
They would say to a librarian, like, yeah, I was involved in this. I, you know, was incarcerated. And then they're coming back to, like, look at the newspaper, you know, accounts of that crime. So, like, sort of reliving.
By the way, if I ever work at a library and someone keeps coming in, frothing at the mouth and obsessing over a murder index, especially the unsolved ones, I'm calling the cops.
I mean, as a public librarian, like, that's not our place to make judgments.
Katie's research skills led her to the story of a man named Russell Hunter, who would also one day claim to have paranormal experiences in the Mile High City.
Russell Hunter, he was a musical arranger for CBS in New York City for about 5 years. His parents ended up buying the Three Birches Lodge in Boulder.
Apparently, Hunter loved the West so much when he visited that he leased an historic home called the Henry Treat Rogers Mansion, built in the late 1890s, only a stone's throw from Cheeseman Park.
We actually have a photo of the house, two stories with an attic and this grand sort of circular staircase. It had a library, a drawing room, a large dining room, butler's pantry, servants' quarters on that first floor. He moved in late December 1968.
All of the information that Katie and I are sharing comes from a 96-page story written by Hunter that is set in that house.
This short story, it says at the beginning, all the events and places in the following story are true. Only the names of people have been changed to not to protect the living, but the dead.
After you hear the story, the real question probably won't be if any of it is true, but did anything actually really happen in that house that inspired Russell Hunter to write his story?
He says the first day that strange things started happening was really February 7th, 1969.
At 6 in the morning, Hunter was woken up by the sound of loud banging in the big empty old house, just like George C. Scott's character was in The Changeling.
He figured it was like the radiator or maybe the, you know, furnace problems or something. It didn't happen for a few days until February 12th. And then again on February 20th, he ended up calling Public Service Company, which was the utility company here. He had them come out to check the furnace and the hot water pipes. They could not find anything wrong with the place.
Hunter's account said that the noise grew more frequent and then also that doors would lock themselves and water would turn on by itself. He wrote about how on one occasion at night he heard water running, but all of a sudden none of the lights in his house would work. So he used a cigarette lighter to go from bathroom to bathroom trying to find the source of the sound. When he entered one darkened bedroom where the sound was the loudest, his lighter ran out of fluid, and he was left to grope in the dark towards the sound of running water from the bathroom off the bedroom without knowing who or what else might be in the room. I think that's my favorite part of his story. Conveniently, after turning the shower off, the lights came back on. At a party, someone told Hunter that he'd also lived in the house, but back then it was a boarding house years before.
And then he mentioned to Hunter, he said, well, you know, there's a third floor, right? And he said, you know, the stairway to it is in that big closet on the second floor.
Hunter returned to his home that night, thinking that all the noises and strange occurrences might be caused by someone else living in his house up beyond the rumored staircase, supposedly hidden in the closet. It should be noted that less than 30 years before Hunter's experiences and less than 5 miles away, Theodore Edward Coney's lived in a man's attic for 5 weeks before the house's owner caught him raiding the fridge. Coney's killed the homeowner right there in the kitchen and then retreated back up to his hiding place. Police were confused about how a man could be bludgeoned to death in his locked home, and the media began calling the killing the Denver Ghost House Slaying. Even after the murder and investigation, Coney continued to live in the house up in the attic for another 9 months, frightening his victim's widow and housekeeper before being caught and arrested in 1941. Because Cody was able to hide in such a small space of the attic and then creep out and even attack someone, he became known as the Denver Spider-Man. My point in sharing this is I wonder if Hunter knew about that crime, if people still talked about it, and if he was thinking about it, as he had to walk up alone to the door of his big house and with a rumored staircase that led up to the attic.
Russell Hunter contacts an architect friend, and he comes over and they examine that big closet. He says, oh yeah, this is a false wall. They knock through the wall and, you know, there's a staircase. Hunter says that it's probably not had anyone there in it for like 30 years. They go up the stairs. It's very dusty. It's windowless up there.
In the Changeling film, Scott's character climbs the hidden staircase and finds a little room with a fireplace, a bathtub, and a creepy old wicker wheelchair covered in cobwebs. I was crushed when Katie told me that Hunter didn't find any of those things in the secret room at the top of the stairs.
They do find an old trunk. They eventually get the trunk open, and all they find are old school books from probably the turn of the century and a journal that had been kept by a child.
The journal was kept by a 9-year-old boy named Eric, who had a clubbed foot and wasn't allowed out of the attic because his parents were embarrassed by his disability. The boy's journal, written in the early 1900s, had color pencil drawings and talked about his love of a red rubber ball that his mom had thrown away.
Russell Hunter was just sitting in the library. He described suddenly hearing bump, 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 and a red rubber ball rolled down the entrance hall into the open doors of the library.
The appearance of the red rubber ball in the story pretty much mirrors what happens in the movie with it as well. Also, like in the movie, the discovery of the secret room led Hunter to invite a medium over.
They're asking the Ouija board questions.
What Hunter learned from the session was that Eric was the heir to a tremendous fortune from his maternal grandfather. Unfortunately, he died in childhood, and his parents, not wanting to lose all control of the money, buried Eric's body discreetly on some farmland outside of Denver they owned, and then quickly adopted an orphan that sort of resembled the boy, passing him off as their son. The movie follows this story of one boy being exchanged for another pretty closely, and that's also how it got the name The Changeling. Apparently, a changeling is a human-like creature left in place of a child kidnapped by fairies or other mythological creatures in Northern European folklore. And trying to find out more about Eric's imposter, the Ouija board sessions continued.
They get this name and this address. The name is Harold W. Squibbs.
I can't find any records for Harold W. Squibbs in Denver in real life, but in the story, the Ouija board says that Harold W. Squibbs was the boy who died and whose identity was assumed by the orphan. He had used his wealth to go to Harvard and become influential in national politics and in corporations, and at the time of the story was in fact still alive and very powerful in Denver. The board said that the farm where Eric's grave was hidden had since been developed into a Denver neighborhood, and it even gave Hunter the address of the home that had unknowingly been built over Eric's remains, saying the boy's body was under the sill of a closet in the oldest daughter's bedroom. Hunter contacted the family at the address, and they blew him off at first until they began to experience hauntings for the first time in their lives right after his contact, and then they agreed to an excavation. Just like in the movie, a deep hole was dug right into a girl's bedroom. Even Roger Ebert, the film critic, commented on how much he liked the shot that contrasted the avocado green of a girl's cozy bedroom with the muddy hole that George C. Scott digs in the middle of it. In both the story and film, the skeleton of a little boy is found under the home. Hunter and the homeowner contacted the police about the little boy's body, but the police are too afraid of the powerful man who would be implicated by the discovery, let alone put off by the flimsy and unprecedented circumstances of how they found the body in the first place. So they urge and then threaten Hunter and the homeowner to keep quiet. In Hunter's story, a police captain involved with the boy's cover-up dies while trying to throw the little boy's necklace found with his body off a bridge over the South Platte River. Hunter loses contact with the homeowner and then moves out of the house after a mirror explodes and cuts his wrist. When he goes back to the house to see its demolition to make room for a newer building, one of its walls falls over and kills the bulldozer operator.
We haven't been able to find anything that would indicate that this is true.
In fact, Katie isn't even 100% sure if Hunter actually lived in the house in question.
We have not been able to pin him to any location in Denver until, you know, well after this time period.
In fact, records about the house from the turn of the century where Eric and possibly Eric's double would have been living says that
there was never really any children living in the house around the time period, early 1900s.
Like I said, Russell Hunter's story is over 90 pages long, and honestly, the first third of it isn't too hard to believe. Most of us have heard weird noises in old houses, whether they're paranormal or not. Also, it's not super uncommon to occasionally find walled-off rooms or artifacts in old houses. In Hunter's story, he even provides two floor plans of the house that seem to match up with the photo of the old place where he says he was living. However, as unskeptical as I tried to be, even I had to admit the story jumped the rails past the point I could suspend my disbelief after the first 30 pages or so. One of the first instances I couldn't get over was that Hunter said a total of 91 visitors had seen paranormal phenomenon in his home, from the Red River Ball to doors that open and close by themselves and rappings like tapping sounds or knockings. According to him, he could even make them happen on demand by asking Eric to do it. I would think that if almost 100 people saw weird things happening in an upscale home, there'd be more of a record of this house and what happened there, especially since it was 1969, when lots of people were getting more open to strange spiritual phenomenon, and it would be less than a decade after that that the Enfield haunting and the Amityville horror would gain international news based on the testimony of way fewer people. The fact that Hunter lists all of these untimely deaths closely associated with the house, like the guy driving the bulldozer, or the police captain, and also one of a real estate mogul that bought the house later who apparently committed suicide in a cemetery, it seems that all or most of these deaths there'd be some record of. It is true that by his own admission, Hunter changed the names of most of the people involved in the story, but given the strangeness and sensationalism of these deaths, if they were real, I think we could find some record of them somewhere. But again, it's not happening. Do you think Russell Hunter is telling the truth?
I think it's some sort of amalgamation of truth, myth, embellishment, theatrics. He made his money off of entertaining people.
In the end, I had to ask myself why I got so excited when I heard that my favorite horror movie might have a connection to real or rumored events in a house only about a 2-hour drive from my house. I think in the same way that people dress up like their favorite characters from movies or TV shows, or write fan fiction, or visit movie locations, they just don't want the story to end. And that's how I feel about The Changeling. Only about a 90-minute drive from where the Changeling house was, if Hunter really did live there, is the Stanley Hotel, where Stephen King freely admits that its one-time isolation and decrepitness and general creepiness at the time gave him the inspiration to write The Shining. Whether he saw something supernatural or not in the Stanley, it's become part of the experience of The Shining to go visit it, and on that note, I'd like to think that somewhere in Denver there is, or there was if it's been torn down, a house where Russell Hunter really did have something scary happen, be it paranormal or bad plumbing, that frightened him into writing my favorite horror movie. I want to thank Katie Rudolph for giving me this interview today, as well as for sharing her research. I've linked the research she did about the Changeling House and Russell Hunter in the description. You can also check out the original trailer for The Changeling in the description. If you do a search for That Doesn't Happen every day is two words in this case, you can listen to all of the episodes I've ever done completely for free. I would also like to thank KHOL Jackson for playing this show as well. I hope to have a new episode to you in about 2 weeks.